Good evening, and welcome to part two of our discussion of charging for healthcare, charging for medical services. Our first part last month was intended to be the sum of the discussion, but we got so involved that we ended up creating a part two. I'm going to quickly summarize what we said last time, insofar as some of it may have relevance and answer questions that people have this time as well. We began. Oh, and I want to make sure to thank Jeff for setting this up once again, and thank the shul for the copies and the space, and let's go. So we began last time with basic material, the question of what justifies charging for health care at all. What justifies a physician saying, I want you to pay me in order to heal you? And the reason why I ask the question is because we are taught that healing is a mitzvah. It actually could be several different mitzvah that you're fulfilling by engaging in healing. Refusing to heal is considered bloodshed. That's the term used in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. And since it's a mitzvah, it may fall under the purview of a passage in the Talmud which says that just like God does certain things for us, we are expected to turn around and do them for others for free. God does it for us for free, we should do that for others for free. So God says to Moshe, I taught you Torah for free, therefore you should teach the Jews for free. And we should say also, God provides healing for free, and therefore we are obligated to provide healing for free. However, the Torah does seem to assume that the doctor will be paid. It talks about the case in which somebody hurts somebody else, and it says that one of the things he has to pay for is medical bills. That's one of the vandal's obligations, is to pay medical bills. So you can't say that unless there is such a thing as a medical bill. Clearly there is an expectation that the doctor is going to be paid, and there are other passages like that. We brought one famous one last time. A doctor who heals for free there was a better way to phrase it. A doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. That was the Talmudic line. So we gave some resolutions, and the basic resolutions, again, making a long story short, were either the minimal resolution, which is to say you pay the doctor for schar batala and schar tircha. Schar batala means payment for not engaging in something else, so that they'll be available to heal people. And schar tircha, payment for whatever strain is involved in, you know, going to the patient, back in the day when doctors went to patients, but going into work, taking care of whatever is needed that involves strain for the physician, as opposed to saying, you're paying for my know-how. You're paying for my tuition in medical school. That would be a different story. That was one approach. Then we had more expansive approaches. So we had an approach that said, you know, doctors deal in a high-risk situation, and therefore to effectively compensate them for putting themselves on the line, whether on the line because of contagion or on the line because of liability, you pay them more. We gave a case, indeed, about liability, where we talked about paying witnesses to witness a bill of divorce, because if they get something wrong, then they're going to need to pay the scribe to write a brand new document, and therefore they're entitled to claim wages. It's sort of combat pay. In order for them to feel like they want to put themselves in this situation, that was one possibility. Another possibility was to say that people can agree to whatever terms they want, meaning you're right, the doctor shouldn't be charging. However, if the doctor says, in order for me to do this, you have to pay X, then the answer is you have to pay X, because that's the agreement. We discussed that at some length. And then finally, we said, society has a compelling interest in making sure there will be doctors. In the event that you say that one cannot pay, or not one cannot pay, excuse me, that one cannot charge, the result will be people will say, okay, so I'm going to become a plumber. And then society will not have people to heal others. So it's a recognition that even though technically it should be for free, in reality you will not have doctors that way, and therefore we license doctors to charge. Those were some of the approaches, again, in brief. We then asked the question, so how much is the physician allowed to charge? If you take the more limited version, the physician is only able to charge for time involved and for not doing other things. So maybe whatever he could have earned in some other livelihood, but within the broader perspective, he can charge, potentially whatever he feels is appropriate to justify his efforts and his investment. As a side note, we discussed whether a doctor is allowed to take a break once we say that it's a mitzvah, maybe a doctor is obligated, whenever there is a patient in need, the doctor is obligated to respond. So we gave grounds for leniency, for saying that no, a doctor is not necessarily on call 24/7. One argument was it makes a doctor a better doctor when they have a chance to take a break. Another approach was that, you know, other doctors can handle it when one is on vacation. There are other doctors around. You're not the only one. We talked about this a little bit. And then the last bit that we discussed was the question of socialized medicine and what Judaism would say of a socialized system of reimbursement for physicians. And we said it would be good to offer as much as possible to physicians, and for people to pay them, you know, whatever they ask. But having said that, the rule is, in fact, as the Talmud records, a community can set whatever prices it wants for anything. A community is entitled to say, this is the way we are going to run our businesses, and what they say has standing within the community. So if the community decides this is what we think is worthwhile, then they're within their rights to do so. The last bit was the question of publishing physician salaries, which was in the paper at the time that we had this conversation. And we did say that as a basic principle, we oppose what is called rechilut. Rechilut is tail-bearing. We oppose divulging information about others, even where the information is not necessarily negative. Nonetheless, we don't believe in divulging information about people's lives. However, we did note that when you're dealing with communal funds, and tax dollars certainly fit into that picture, how you work out what people pay a physician is a good question. But in general, when you're dealing with communal funds, we do expect a public accounting, which is going to tell people what is being spent. That comes from the laws of tzedakah. So if that's the best way to help, by publishing the data, so be it. However, that would fall short of justifying a system in which you publish the name of the particular doctor along with the salary. You could just as easily publish some kind of a code, right? Like in university, when they put up, I don't know if they still do this, I assume they do, when they list the grades on an exam, so they don't list the person's name and then the grade, but each person has a particular code that's their number, and they list the numbers along with the grades. Is that how they do it here? I'm seeing some no's and some yeses, so I guess
well,
it depends.
50 years ago, 40 years ago, they did.
Okay. But that would be a way to handle it, such that you can provide society with the information that is needed in order for people to be informed about the state of healthcare without creating a situation in which you embarrass people and divulge information about them personally. Okay, that's all from last time. I'm assuming that the goal of publishing the information is not to embarrass people. If the goal is shaming, that's another story. That's a separate conversation. We begin this time with the question of refusing to treat without payment. We've established that a physician is allowed to charge. We've discussed the extent to which a physician is able to charge. Is a physician able to say, so-and-so is coming to me, and they can't pay, obviously in a socialized system that's going to be less relevant for general care. But let's say what they need is something unique that's not covered. And they're coming to you and saying, I really need this. It isn't covered. Treat me anyway. Or outside of a socialized system where they come in and you ask for their insurance card and they say, actually, I'm not insured. So is the doctor licensed to say, then I'm sorry, I can't treat you. I can't do so. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number one, you find a sharp line from Rashi, the classic commentator to the Talmud. The Talmud at the end of the volume called Kiddushin has a line which doctors always enjoy hearing. It says, Tov shebarof im legehinom. The best of doctors, or the good doctors, go to Gehinom. Gehinom being hell. So what in the world does that mean? Various explanations are offered. Everyone has their favorite explanation, and it's a good topic for another time. But that would be a good title for a class, and then we could talk about the line. We could just make it like a flyer with flames on the bottom. But if you take a look at source number one, you find Rashi's comment. He says, number one, Eino mishaber libo lamakom. It's talking about a doctor who does not literally subdue his heart before God. That's number one. Meaning, he's arrogant. He doesn't approach it with humility because he feels, look, I can heal people. Right? I am a god. Upa'amim shaharig nefashot. And sometimes he kills people. That's a second problem, is the doctor who doesn't succeed. And or maybe that's an extension of Rashi's first point, which is he is arrogant, and as a result of his arrogance, he makes mistakes. But then his latter point, v'yesh biyado l'rapot ha'ani ve'eino merape. He has the ability to heal somebody who is needy, but he doesn't do it. So such a person, Rashi says, that's a person who is destined for Gehinnom for refusing to pay somebody. So Rashi would seem to be closing the conversation on whether you can decline to treat somebody. Now, there is the argument in response of, well, you know, there are other physicians. I am not robbing him of health care. He could go to somebody else. The answer to that is a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, which states, the Jerusalem Talmud is Ketuvot, that not everybody is healed. I didn't bring it on your sheet. Not everybody is healed by every doctor. Meaning, either some doctors are better than others, or some doctors simply have a rapport with the patient. Maybe they know how to explain things to the patient in such a way that the patient will follow through properly with the treatment. They're able to ask the right questions and get the right information out of the patient. They're more familiar with this particular condition. They know the patient's history. There are all sorts of reasons why one physician may be more successful with a particular patient than another physician. So therefore, when the doctor says, well, you know, it's not about me, you go to somebody else, the answer is maybe not. Maybe what you have is unique, and therefore you're not justified in declining to treat. On the other hand, if you take a look at source number 2, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in his Nishmat Avram records a comment from one of his mentors, Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, who passed away in the last couple of years. He says, "Ve'he'irli mori Rabbi ha'Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth shlita." Rabbi Neuwirth pointed out the following thing to me. Umayya adam sheyesh lo ne'emanut rak legabei rofei misuyam. He says, what's going to be the case when you have a person who only trusts a certain physician, right? Like we are suggesting that you can't decline to treat because maybe you are the one who can take care of this patient and others can't. But he says, follow that through. Now what's going to happen? He says, v'im ki yesh rofim bechinam al v'rotzim dav gezeh shalokeach kesef. What if he only wants this doctor? There are other doctors who treat for free. This doctor charges. Right? So now you're going to tell me, because this is the only doctor he wants, ha'im kofino talarapot b'chinam. Are we going to now compel him to treat for free? Right? Because there are other doctors who treat for free. This patient says, I don't want to go to the others who treat for free. I want to go to this one who charges. But I don't want to pay him anything. And you're going to tell me, well, you're not entitled to refuse. So now you're going to force him to treat for free because this fellow says, that's the only doctor for me. Like, how far are you going to go with this argument of view it as though you're the only doctor in the world because maybe you're the only one who can treat him? Are we really going to go that far? So the truth of the matter is that there are those who are indeed willing to go that far and to say, no, you're not entitled to refuse. We're going to get to the question of work actions in a moment. But before we get to that, I wanted to show you one line of argument that's brought to justify this that isn't about you being the only physician in the world for this patient. In other words, one argument to compel him is Rashi's point. That it's when Rashi connects it to Tov Shevarof Im LeGehinom, that it's terrible behavior to refuse to treat somebody. The second argument is really fundamentally different. And it's saying that the reason is because really you may be the one who's able to cure him. Right? Those are two different points. I didn't delineate it carefully enough. But they're really two different points. One point is it's about your personal behavior. Right? It's bad for somebody to be able to heal people and say, I'm not going to because they won't pay me. The second argument is, you may actually be the only one who's able to heal him. To which we have Rav Neuwirth's response, well, does that mean then every doctor is always going to be compelled to treat and to treat for nothing because you'll make that argument? But there's a third point, which emerges from a discussion regarding circumcision. If you take a look at source number 3, this is from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, specifically the part authored by Rabbi Moshe Isserles in Poland in the middle of the 16th century. He says, he's describing a situation in which a moel is refusing to circumcise for free, and the family isn't paying. So what happens? He says, Bim omeid bimerdo. If the physician stands by his refusal to circumcise, Ve'ein yad ha'ish maseget latet lo scharo. And the father can't afford to pay him. It's not that the father doesn't want to pay him, but he can't afford the mo'el's fee. Have kemisha ein lo av. So we treat the child like someone who doesn't have a father. What happens if, Rahman al-Itzlan, but it happens, what happens if there's a kid who's born and the father is dead, out of the picture, whatever it is? Generally speaking, the obligation to circumcise does fall upon the father specifically. So the father is not in the picture to do it. Who takes care of making sure this kid gets a bris? The answer is the Beit Din. The local rabbinical court is responsible to make sure that he's taken care of. Just like a rabbinical court is responsible for all sorts of communal needs, they're responsible to look after this child's brit milah as well. They're like his legal guardian for this purpose. So in this case, there is a father, but the father can't afford to pay the mo'el. So what happens, right, to Rabbi Yisraelis? The obligation reverts to the local rabbinical court. And what would then happen? The court turns to the mo'el and says, now do the bris. Because courts are able to, well, I shouldn't jump to the because. You follow what we're saying. The Beit Din can force the mo'el to do the circumcision. Now, you don't necessarily want a mo'el who's working under duress. Nonetheless, it's within their ability to do that. And there are two explanations that are offered for why the Beit Din is able to do this. The Vilna Gaon, writing in his commentary to the Code of Jewish Law on this law, wrote that the court is able to do this because the court in general is able to compel performance of a mitzvah, having nothing to do with a circumcision case. If the court sees that people in town are being lax about a particular mitzvah, they do have within their rights that they could say, we are going to compel you to do this mitzvah. What exactly are their tools that they have at their disposal is a good question for another discussion. But they have the ability to compel people to actually comply with Jewish law. So he says that's what's going on here. They're compelling the mo'el to circumcise, because he has the opportunity to engage in a mitzvah by doing this. That's one argument. The other argument is the one that I brought you here on your sheet in source number 4. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing a few decades ago, he's talking about whether the argument regarding the mo'el is transferable to the case of a physician. So his argument, saying it outside of the text first, his argument is that the courts have an obligation to take care of people. Not having to do with circumcision, but the court has an obligation in general to take care of people's needs. They are overseeing the needs of the Jewish community. And in that respect, they take care of making sure the circumcision happens. But also, he says, that will apply to physicians as well. If you take a look now at what he says in source number 4, he says, V'areini mok zelo shayach b'ni doneinu. He says, the reason of Rabbi Yisraelis, a reason first that's circumcision specific, would not necessarily be relevant for us regarding doctors. Im lo shen omar gamkein, de'be'ein yad ha'chola maseget l'rapeyot atzmo, chal al ha'beidin shehim ha'yad aniyim, chiyuv l'rapot et hadal hazeh, mikoach chiyuv ha'dechiv ha'tor ba'avah ha'shev oto, lo l'rapot avidat gufo. He says, we could argue that where a patient lacks the ability to heal himself, the court operates as yad ha'aniyim, the hand of the needy, which we find in other areas of Jewish law. The court has the ability to operate as the hand of the needy, and therefore, they are going to act on behalf of this needy person. There is a mitzvah of Hashevo Tolo, you shall restore it to him. If someone loses something, you have to give it back to him. And that applies to one's health as well. So therefore, the court is going to be responsible to heal this person, and they're going to turn to the doctor, as he continues to say, and compel the doctor to do so. So the bottom line out of this is that we would argue you could compel a doctor to treat, number one, Rashi's argument that it's a very bad trait to refuse to treat somebody who needs your help when you have the ability to do so. Number two, the argument that that his aid specifically may be what saves this person. He can't rely on somebody else. That's a response to him saying, maybe somebody else could do it. And number three, the third point is that the rabbinical court that's responsible for making sure that people comply with Jewish law, or responsible to look after the needs of people, depending on which way you formulate it, but they indeed could compel the doctor and say, get to work. Yes? Yeah, I mean, I wish them a lot of luck, you know, in general, in trying to do this. It's true.
But nobody's doing that nowadays. Because, like, there's many people who are sick. I'm not saying physically, but, like, people have mean root canals or have infections in their teeth. And go to a Jewish Orthodox dentist and say, you know, do me a root canal for free.
Right.
Because I don't have money.
Right.
They'll throw you right out.
Right,
and
so we have to...
There's
an idea.
Well,
we have more to discuss. We're not done with this topic yet, but let's see. You know, but yeah, hold on, Laura, and then. So that's a really good question. Maybe the court's ability is to compel the doctor to treat. But then they have to pay him. Courts have resources from communal funds that are, you know, and frankly, they have the ability to tax the community. So let them create a medical tax. And essentially what we will end up with, you know, is socialized medicine. Right? The Beit Din is going to charge everybody money, and then they get to turn around and disperse it to the doctors. That's what we will create by doing this. But maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's really where this is going. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, this is obviously unique to our situation. Yes. That's what you're going to talk about also. Okay. Yes.
So, my question is, if there is another bio available or another doctor available, but I prefer to use this doctor, this model, because I feel they could do a better job, why is the onus on the bed exam or the community or anybody else? If I have a choice of another doctor, I feel more comfortable than paying his fee.
Right.
Or that I want this model because I feel he's specialized and he's a greater top, whatever. Pay
right.
His fee. You don't like it, go to somebody else. Is
right.
Is this the case where there's only one in a town and there is no other choice? Or is this the case even if there is a choice because of the doctor? Why you said even if the others are free?
Right. So that was Rabbi Neuwirth's objection in source number two. Source number two. That was his objection. And I think, and here I'm going out on a little bit of a limb, but I think the logical conclusion to draw from his objection is that the patient who wants this particular doctor would be obligated to demonstrate in some way that this is the only doctor who can take care of them. Even assuming we're going to go this route, which I didn't say we're going to go. We're not done with this conversation. We're sort of at a midpoint. But but even if we will say that the court is able to compel, or that the individual doctor's own conscience should be compelling him to treat, it could be argued that that's only where the patient demonstrates that there is a need for this particular physician. He's been my family doctor for the last 30 years, and therefore he knows me better than anybody else does. Or she is a specialist in this particular field, and no, there is no one else around who's able, I would have to travel 2 hours, take a plane flight, whatever it is, in order to be able to get treatment. I think that that is a reasonable argument, but I don't know that it's correct. Laura. Right, and that takes us into two other fields, right? Field number one is how we define medical care. And does medical care mean something that a doctor does, or does medical care mean something that has been tested and determined to work? We've discussed that, I think, on other occasions, and we do require a demonstration that a particular therapy, a particular medicine is effective in order for there to be the title of medicine, you know, in general upon it. So I think that's, you know, that's one point that has to be, you know, that has to be examined. There was something else also that you had reminded me of by asking that question about going abroad. Oh, right. The other question is, you know, what happens where a patient says, I want to have a certain therapy, and the doctor doesn't just feel it's unnecessary, but actually feels it's harmful, right? So we had a class, I gave a class at the Bayit in the fall on the issue of refusing medical care, and there that ties into the question of dictating what I want and saying that now the doctor has to do that. And the answer, generally speaking, is no, but it's a lot more complicated than that. You know, just to introduce one source as an example of that, we say that on Yom Kippur, if someone says, I need food now, and you have a doctor around, the doctor says, no, you don't, you'll be okay. But the patient says, I know, I need food, we feed him. Right? Because we say a person's heart knows the bitterness of his soul. He knows what he's experiencing more than the external observer. Well, move on from that then to the case in which the patient says, I need penicillin. The doctor says, no, you don't need penicillin. You have a cold. The patient says, no, I need penicillin. Yeah, and the doctor says, well, you know, penicillin could be bad for you, or whatever it is, fill in the blank with whatever treatment the patient demands. How far, you know, do you go in saying, well, the patient knows his own body best? Not simple and straightforward, but this is a tangent, so I'm going to go back to where we were, which is, we now have presented arguments for compelling the physician to treat the patient gratis. So that brings us to the question of work actions, strikes, etc. So if you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, in his Nishmat Avram, writes, Lefi chukei Torah, by Torah law, Yachol Beit Din kishiyado takifa, lidon b'inyan, kvar b'chlata sichsuch. He says, you know, if there's some kind of a fight going on, in which the doctors say, we should be paid more, and whoever their employer is, hospital, province, whatever it is saying, well, we're not going to pay you, so he says, by Torah law, that's where your courts come into play. And the court sits down and hears both sides and manages the negotiation. He says the court would be able to obligate both sides to accept a righteous verdict, with the foundation principle being, we want the best possible treatment for patients. So, in an ideal world, you have that. Of course, you know, you have arbitrators, mediators, you know, and so on. So let them negotiate. But what happens when that doesn't play out? So, you know, Jeff was kind enough to send me links for the College of Physicians and Surgeons. And looking at their policy, they say, well, first of all, the physicians have to exhaust all other options. That's just a sort of a blanket statement. You have to exhaust all other options. And then, if they are going to engage in a work action, they need to make sure that withdrawal of physician services is not going to permit harm to individual patients. Now, I don't know exactly what that looks like. But I do know what happened. Because in 1983, in Israel, there was such a hospital strike over several hospitals in Israel by physicians there. I gave you, if you take a look at source number 6, there was an article by J. David Bleich in the journal Tradition, in which he covered what had happened in that strike, and I gave you the link so that you could look up the article where he goes into it at great length. But basically, he says there were different rabbis who came out with different stances. So the Kleisenberger Rebbe said, no, you're not allowed to go on strike, based on things that we've said, based on the points that we've raised. And so those who listened to him said, we're not going out on strike. Rav Shlomo Gorin, at the time, prohibited going on strike, but offered a different solution. He said the physicians have to show up to work, but they can demand their fees in advance of anything they do. Because we said last time, the physician has a right to charge because you can make an agreement with anybody, you know, and say, I want X, and then they have to pay you whatever they agreed to. So let the physician show up to work and say, okay, you want me to do whatever it is? This is what it's going to cost you. Okay. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, Mincha Yitzchak, as well as Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, issued letters to the physicians and said, you can go on strike as long as you make sure that you keep a minimum staffing level in the hospital to ensure that lives are not lost. And they gave an interesting parallel. They said, keep the same levels that you would have on Shabbat. That was their answer, figuring that at Shabbat you have a minimum staffing level in a community where Shabbat is a value, obviously. So you're going to keep a minimum staffing level there. That's what you have to observe. Rabbi J. David Blank, when he recorded this, noted that that's not quite adequate. And the reason it's not adequate is that won't work long term. Right? Minimum staffing may work one day out of every seven. But if you try running a hospital for days and weeks at a time on minimum staffing levels, you're going to run into trouble. You're overtaxing your minimum staff. But that was one point they made. Then, as things advanced within the work action, it actually reached a stage where they were doing a hunger strike. So he said, no, you can't do a hunger strike, because that's going to weaken your ability to serve the patient. Right? A doctor on a hunger strike may make mistakes. So he said, you can't do anything that's going to affect your ability to provide proper care. But this was a case in action. And there were people who said, there were doctors who said, I'm going to show up because my rabbi says I have to. And then there were rabbis who said, well, within these certain limited terms, a work action would be possible. And so they followed that approach. I encourage you to read Rabbi Blake's article. It's a very readable article. And he gives you more information than I've just given you regarding the ins and outs of what happened and the arguments. Added notes on this. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Tzirilson, in his Atzei HaLevanon, notes that, you know, we have all these obligations and all of these mitzvot of treating people. We have to remember, the mitzvot of treating people are not only about saving lives. They're also about restoring health in general. The root canal case, for example. It's about restoring health in general. So that is very important, because when you say, keep a minimum staffing level to ensure that nobody dies, that's not really our definition of a successful medical system. We don't want to just say, nobody died. We would like to say, people were healthy. So his argument is that you have to have a higher standard for what you're going to do for patients. That's number one. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Tzirilson, it's Atzei HaLevanon 61. The other point that is very important is regarding the idea that was suggested of charging and specifying your costs in advance. Because that's a trick. It's a trick if you're in a hospital system. Rabbi Bleich is the one who points this out in source number 6. He says, the physician who stipulates his fee in advance may collect the amount stipulated because acceptance of his services is to be construed as acquiescence to the term stipulated, right? That's why does it work when you say, I want X number of dollars, and now that person is obligated to pay you because he accepted the treatment, he's obligating himself to pay. But he says, such constructive acquiescence is inferred because the patient accepts the benefit conferred without demur, right? Without saying, wait a minute, I don't want to pay. However, in the Israeli dispute, the doctors sought compensation not from the patients, but from the government, or from the hospitals which employ them. So the government might counter with the argument that since it receives no direct benefit from the physician's services, failure to engage in a lockout does not constitute acquiescence. In other words, they're going to say, sure, the patient said, I am willing to take the services, right? The doctor said, I insist that I be paid $100, $1,000, whatever it is, for this service. The patient said, okay, treat me. But the patient isn't the one writing the check. The hospital is the one writing the check. So you'll say, well, the hospital allowed the doctor to use their facility. They didn't lock him out. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're agreeing to pay his wages. That just means they didn't lock him out of the building. So therefore, that argument may not go over so powerfully. But those are the arguments that are staked out within this. I think fundamentally, I have to go back to a point that was made in the first half by one of the writers. It was, if I can find the reference quickly in my sheets, Rabbi Moshe Steinberg in the journal Asya. He said, it's true that for physicians, healing people is a mitzvah. And therefore, they have a moral obligation to carry out their duty to heal. However, the patients are supposed to want to pay for the reasons that we have already outlined, because the doctor is putting in his time and effort, because the doctor is not engaging in other things, because we need doctors within the community to take care of people. All the different reasons that we gave impose a moral obligation on the patient to pay the physician. So it isn't as though the patient is within his rights to knock on the door and say, it's your mitzvah, take care of me. I am here to provide you with a mitzvah opportunity. I am your mitzvah for the day. It's not appropriate for the patient to do it. Of course, the problem that we run into is not the patient who can pay and refuses, but the patient who says, look, my checkbook's empty, you know, but I need treatment. That's really where we run into trouble, and where I would argue it's the responsibility then, to go back to what we said before, it's the responsibility of the Beit Din, as overseer of the needs of the community, to say, okay, how are we going to treat the people who can't afford it, and make sure the doctors are not going broke spending their time treating people who can't pay them. And that does indeed lead you in the socialized direction, potentially. Whether that's the best solution for the problem or not is a policy question that requires people who are smarter than I am and have devoted a lot of time to how this works or doesn't work, as the case may be. But I think fundamentally, the obligation of solving this problem does not reside with the individual physician. The obligation of solving this problem resides with whoever is responsible for the general communal welfare. That's who's supposed to be figuring this out. That's what I would say. Clear so far? Sure there is. We call it government. No, I'm not kidding. There's no Beit Din that oversees things like this. Not here, anyway. And not in any community, frankly, that I'm familiar with. In a world in which you have such a Beit Din, great. Otherwise, it becomes the responsibility of whatever government. I mean, you had in Talmudic times something called the Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir, the essentially town council, seven people who were chosen within the community to serve as the community's representatives, and they were the government. And they got involved in all sorts of things. They stuck their noses everywhere. They were responsible for fixing prices. They were responsible for fixing terms of labor. All sorts of things. And yes, it would have been their responsibility, presumably, to take this on and to say, okay, we're going to set this straight and make sure that people are taken care of. Yeah.
In some cultures, in the professional world, there's a sort of accepted principle that a certain proportion of your work is just these kinds of cases.
Right. Yeah, pro bono. Right. So I don't know how that works in the medical world. I've heard of it in the legal world. I don't know how that works in the medical world. Is that a phenomenon?
Yeah.
I saw a no and a yes. It is.
Well, it certainly has been 40 years ago. Doctors would have their offices and they'd get paid for services. But it was understood that once a week, a morning, or once a month, you go for a morning and work in a clinic pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
So that was understood, and you didn't receive anything.
So we have a report.
It's a charitable
kind
of thing. But that, I'm not up to date if that's still going on. I don't think. Now the provincial government now pays, so I think doctors continue to get paid whether they work in an office or they go to the clinic. They still draw OHIP.
Right.
The other thing I just want to leave before I forget the point. The provincial government here has stated very clearly, under OHIP rules, you cannot, for medically necessary services, you cannot ask for payment in advance of the service.
Right. The question, though, is that's all well and good for things that are covered, but as was pointed out, let's say dentistry,
right.
You're out of luck.
That's right.
Jeff.
I know it was see the example where the Beijing would not have to create a socialized medicine system for the community as a whole, as we have in Canada, arguably, but they could allow doctors to charge and work in their private system, so to speak, and then have another system running parallel to it where people...
Well, that exists in Israel.
Yes.
That kind of a system. Okay. So we move on to the second part. And the second part is about accepting payment to work on Shabbos. Here's the problem. If you take a look at source number 7, a passage in the Talmud that at first glance has nothing to do with medical care. Hasocher es hapoa lishmor es hapara. The para aduma, the red heifer, is used in purification rituals. So you have this red heifer that is not yet ready, evidently, for use, because if it was ready for use, it wouldn't be alive anymore. And they want to guard it. It needs to be guarded because any number of activities that one engages in with it could actually disqualify it from its use for this service. So, for example, if someone rides on it, that's it. It's disqualified. So if somebody hires a worker to guard the cow, you can't pay him for guarding the cow on Shabbos. Now, guarding the cow involves no violation of Shabbat labor, meaning he's not taking it out for a spin, so to speak. He's sitting there watching the grass grow. That's what he's doing. You could do that just as easily on Shabbos as you could on Wednesday. However, what we are learning here is that Schar Shabbat, payment for work done on Shabbat, even where the work is 100% permissible, there's nothing wrong with guarding the cow, nonetheless, it is prohibited. You're not allowed to pay for work done on Shabbat. This is a rabbinic prohibition, part of the general prohibition against engaging in commerce on Shabbat. That's the idea. It's rabbinic prohibition, lest you write things down. Because once you tell people that they can be paid for something they do on Shabbat, the first thing they're going to do is write up what hours they did and that somebody owes them money, because that's what we do when we want to make sure that we get paid. So there's a rabbinic prohibition, which is the problem for us in our discussion. Because the doctor who shows up for work because they're on call, or somebody showed up at their door and said, "Help, we have this situation," whatever it is, can he get paid for what he does on Shabbos? Or do we say that's Tzchar Shabbat? So this is much discussed. And there are four different grounds that are brought to permit payment for work done on Shabbat in medical care. Each argument has nuances that will affect the practical implementation of this. The first argument is, and this is how you may have heard of in other contexts, something called havla'a. Hebrew speakers, what does livlo'a mean in Hebrew? To swallow, right. Havla'a, swallowing up. And the idea is, essentially, that you include the work done on Shabbos with the work done during the week. If you take a look at source number 8, the Hebrew is on one side, the English to the top of the second side. From Mordechai ben Hillel's commentary appears. In the back of the Talmud is a commentary on the Talmud that focuses on Jewish law in particular. He says, Pasak harav Rabbeinu Baruch, mikani yesh li chashash al hachazanim shemaskirim otam litpalel b'shabbat. He says, commenting on the Talmud's discussion about payment for work done on Shabbos, he says, if you're not supposed to take payment for work done on Shabbos, then how is it that you have a chazan who gets hired to daven on Shabbos? And he says, I'm not so sure that's okay. V'harav Rabbeinu Shmuel, in brackets you have the word b'ni, my son, Rabbeinu Shmuel, Omer de'ein isur, he says there's no problem. Why? T'hanos n'lo sachar l'kayim ha-mitzvah l'itpalil, because we are paying him for fulfilling the mitzvah of davening. We're going to come back to that idea. That's not the point. The point, rather, is what happens next. If you take a look at source number 9, the Mordechai says this in 13th century Germany. Well, when you move forward almost two centuries to Rabbi Yisrael of Brunna in Germany and his responsum on the topic, he writes, he's dealing with a different case. He's not dealing with a chazan. He's dealing with a midwife case. on the question of whether you could pay a midwife who comes to help someone give birth on Shabbos. And he says, venerally, it appears to me, da'af ki hai gavna, kavar hi muskeret, he says, she is already hired. The midwife is already hired by everybody, by which he means, she's not just being paid because she came to give birth, to help some woman give birth now. She in general has this career of being a midwife. The community hires her to serve as a midwife in general. So he says, L'kulei ama chashuv b'havla'ah. That's considered to be havla'ah. When she helps somebody give birth on Shabbos, it's absorbed in the payment that she's getting in general for helping women give birth. V'yotz'ah b'dayanim. And she could, in fact, claim payment in court if somebody refused. She is fully entitled to this payment. And then he adds a different note. He says, Mishum sakana, because of danger. And I'm going to come back to the danger point. It's a distraction right now. But the message that we get right here, and if you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing several decades ago, made this point explicit. He says, included within the wages that the midwife is receiving is an accounting, as he writes, for the fact that she's perpetually hired for everybody to be dedicated for this role. She makes herself available at all times. Meaning, brass tacks, what we're saying is, even though the bill that she gives you says, Shabbos, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., pay me $60, $15 an hour. I'm making this up, obviously, but, you know, in those days, back in those days, $15 was a real amount of money. When she presents this bill, it's not really a bill for 4 hours of work on Shabbos morning. It's a bill for serving the community as a midwife in general. Even though the time that she was in your house was these 4 hours on Shabbos, that's not really what you're being billed for. It is absorbed in the fact that she makes herself available in general as a midwife. So that's one argument, is it's really absorbed in generally being a physician, generally providing medical care. That's one argument. The second argument is that it's a mitzvah. Much like the idea that the Mordechai, I think, was getting at before when he said the chazan is being paid for a mitzvah. It's not like payment for work, it's payment for a mitzvah pursuit. If you take a look at source number 11, indeed, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, Asur l'skor chazanim l'itpalel b'shabbat. We know who didn't like the chazan. He says, you're not allowed to hire a chazan to daven on Shabbos. And then that's it. If you don't like chazan, you can stop right there. But he says, V'yesh mishematir, but there are those who permit. And that is an argument that is brought to justify this, as well as in a separate piece to justify hiring someone to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Why is it that having this as a mitzvah should make it okay? So it's a mitzvah. You're still getting paid for doing something on Shabbos. Why does it being a mitzvah help you? So Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer wrote a piece on this. It's printed in a book called Halacha Urafua, in which he quoted Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, from 18th century Hungary. And the argument that Rabbi Sofer brought is that the prohibition against getting paid for work on Shabbos is not about profiting from Shabbos actions. Rather, it's a rabbinic prohibition against engaging in actions on Shabbos specifically to earn wages. It's about I'm not supposed to do something on Shabbos with the intent of, I want to make money. But where the person is doing a mitzvah, they're davening, leading the davening, they're blowing shofar, or in our case, the doctor, what they're doing is, I want to do a mitzvah, right? Doctors in healthy situations do not show up to work thinking, this is great, I'm making money today. They think, this is great, I'm making people healthy today. If they're thinking, this is great, I'm making money today, it might be time for a conversation. But he says, that's the way I look at the case of the chazan. The chazan isn't showing up in shul on Shabbos and saying, I am here to make money. He's saying, I'm here to daven. And therefore, schar Shabbos, the payment would not be prohibited. That's the argument that he quotes from the Chasam Sofer. Yes, Adina.
Why would he, in the case of the chazan or blowing shofar,
but it's not the sole motivation for his activity. He's davening. At the end of the day, he's doing a mitzvah. It's true that he's getting paid as well. Nonetheless, keep in mind, this isn't a biblical prohibition. This is a rabbinic decree. And what they're suggesting is, the rabbis created it with certain things in mind. And what they had in mind was, we don't want a situation in which people engage in activities that they're doing specifically to make money, because then they're going to come to write it down and so on. So the thought is, when the activity they're engaging in is an activity which has a separate value, having nothing to do with making money, but davening, blowing shofar, or in this case, healing, that would be the justification. There was another hand. Jeff.
The issue is that the greater good, the interest of the community as a whole, outweigh even the possibility that what the chazan is doing is...
So we're going to get to such an idea. We're not, that's not this idea. That's coming. Yeah. Alan.
Socialized medicine we have in Canada. If doctors are billing only on a per case basis, and every time they go to work, they're going to make some money for seeing their patient. But if a doctor's on a salary, then he's not told which days he has to work. He's there to treat patients when they need it.
Right.
And when the government talks about what sad physicians earn, they mix up the two. Because the people who are billing OBIP individually, they got to pay all kinds of expenses out of that, which a physician is on salary doesn't have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not comfortable. And to call it a salary is...
Right. Right. And as I prepared for the first half of this, I studied up on all the blended capitation and stuff like that, and it's all out of my head by now. I need to make room. But right. But yeah, that would create an entirely different system, and it would have to be looked at differently. The challenge to this idea, though, that Rabbi Meltzer quotes from the Chasam Sofer, is what we saw back in source number 7. Guarding the red heifer is also a mitzvah. Right? So if you're going to tell me that a mitzvah is not included within this prohibition, why was it that you couldn't get paid in order to guard the para aduma, to guard the red heifer? So if you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector offered a solution for this problem. He said, "V'adai di yesh lahatir li tol scharo, mishum hachtai mashalote machshilan le'atid lavo." His answer was that part of the justification... Actually, one second. Is that the piece that I wanted for this? No, that's not the piece of his responsum that I wanted. It is from his responsum, but it's not what I wanted. What I wanted to say from him is guarding the para, guarding the cow, is not a specialty. Anybody is able to do, you know, this job of guarding the cow. That doesn't require, you know, I can watch it and make sure nobody comes in and rides it. Someone else can watch it and make sure nobody comes in and rides it. You know, whatever it is. Anybody can do it. And therefore, you can find someone to do it for free. As opposed to the case of being the chaz, in the case of blowing the shofar, that's a specialized... that's a specialized activity, and therefore you would therefore you would say, okay, we do have to pay somebody to do this. You don't have the ability to just take anybody. Okay, but that's all within the second approach, justifying accepting payment because it's a mitzvah. The third argument is that it would be dangerous in the event that you didn't have these people here to heal. I'm not dealing with the shofar and the chazan case, but rather talking about the doctor case again. And this goes back to what Jeff was saying. It's a communal necessity to make sure that you are going to have people there to heal. And that was the second point raised by Mahari Bruna, Rabbi Yisrael of Bruna, in source number 9. Right? After Rabbi Yisrael of Bruna mentioned the point about Havla'ah, that the payment that she receives on Shabbos as a midwife is absorbed in the fact that she's generally a midwife for the community, he then continued to say that there's the element of sakana, there's the element of danger as well. What do you mean? Dilma iyada de lo leisev la sachar lo asya. Maybe if she knew she wasn't going to be paid, she wouldn't show up. Omi dat tzelet the mitzvah, or she would be lazy about the mitzvah. The concern is, Rabbi Bruna says, that you have you have danger. If we don't pay them, we're going to have real problems. And therefore, you're right. Essentially, this tag is, you're right, it's payment for work on Shabbos. Normally, we wouldn't do that. But here, there is an overwhelming value of making sure that we will have physicians who will go take care of people on Shabbos. Now, that raises a certain question. Why did Mahari Bruna need to say this? If, after all, his first point about Havla'ah, that it's absorbed with everything else, was already good enough. Why did he need to introduce the argument of danger? So several answers I suggested. One answer, Rabbi Chaim Porush, in the work Halacha Refu'ah, he quotes somebody else, the Tiferet Tzvi, he says, it's because if Havla'ah was sufficient, then it would have worked for the red heifer guarding case. The fact that they didn't mention the Havla'ah answer for the red heifer impelled him to say, I need to find another justification, so therefore I'm going to mention danger as a justification. That's one answer. Another answer that's suggested is because Havla'ah won't work if you really are just here on the spot when you're needed. You're a doctor on vacation, right? You're on vacation, you're spending Shabbos on a cruise, in a hotel, whatever it is. You aren't their doctor, you aren't their doctor all year round, you aren't even their doctor any day. On Shabbos, somebody is sick and needs a doctor, and they say, is anybody a doctor? And you say, oh, I'm a doctor, and you take care of it. At that point, the Havla'ah argument doesn't exist. Because they're not paying you to be a doctor in general. They're paying you to be a doctor today. So that's why we need the sakana argument, the argument of, we're justified in doing so because of the case of danger. That's a second approach. Last approach I'll mention on that, Rabbi Waldenberg mentions in source number 13, and I brought it in entirety because I thought that it was worth reading. He says, I'll read it in the English because we're already getting towards the end of our time here. He says, it appears that the two reasons, meaning the reason of Havla'ah, that you're paying them because it's absorbed with everything else, as well as the reason of Sakana, of danger, these two reasons require each other. He says, meaning, at first he, Rabbi Yisrael of Bruna, in source number 9, wrote to explain there's a foundation for permitting accepting payment. The first point about Havla'ah allows the doctor to accept payment, or midwife in his case. And the midwife who accepts payment is not viewed as accepting it in a prohibited way. This is because the payment is considered Havla'ah, since she has a standing position for everyone. At the end, when he mentioned danger, he explained there is also an obligation to pay this, and that those who are to pay cannot claim, we believe there's a prohibition of payment for Shabbos, sorry, I'm not going to pay, and so escape paying. That could create a circumstance in which another woman giving birth could be endangered, as the midwife might not want to come, or might be slow in the matter. So he's saying there are two different issues here. Havla'ah justifies the doctor accepting payment. Danger justifies paying the doctor. You follow? That's the argument that Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg brings. So there's more to say, but that's a third. Again, what we're doing is, we saw already you're not supposed to have payment for work done on Shabbos. So what we're trying to do is figure out why is it then okay for doctors to accept payment on Shabbos. Our first argument is it's absorbed within payment for their general services. Salary case would be a great example. Or just the fact that they became physicians and served the community in general. That's number one. Number two, the argument that it's a mitzvah. Number three, it's a communal need. And number four, last point, in source number 14, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank says, Yesh la'osif, oh, you have to add another point. It may be true that I'm engaging in my medical act on Shabbos, but I'm healing them so that they'll be better beyond Shabbos. This isn't the patch job, right? We want them to be better on Tuesday also. They're not paying me because of what I did on Shabbos. They're paying me for my good health going forward. Yes, Ellen.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Is that the parking lot on Shabbos? Is it going to be
Well, no, it's not quite as bad as what you're describing. The analogy I would give would be, if I am planning on parking there on I'm going to leave my car there on Friday, okay? And I'm going to leave my car from Friday until Tuesday. I am justified in paying them, not just for the Friday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I can pay them for the time my car was there on Shabbos. But you'll tell me you're paying for a Shabbos service? That's okay. Because it's havla. It's absorbed with everything else. I think that actually is fine. It's not that I'm paying on Shabbos. We're not talking about giving money on Shabbos. So why wouldn't that be okay? See, the reason I find this funny, and maybe this is what you're getting at and I'm not hearing it, but the reason I find this funny is because we don't view paying doctors as paying for the product. We view it as paying for the service, right? We're paying them for the hocus pocus that they did on Shabbos, which makes me better, you know, every day thereafter, but it's for what they did on Shabbos. And the proof of it is, if they did whatever they did on Shabbos and I didn't get better, I would still have to pay them for it. So clearly we're not paying for the health, we're paying for their intervention. That's what makes this a difficult to sustain argument. Nonetheless, I thought it was a really interesting point of view, and that's why I brought it. A couple of other notes that relate to this. Number one, I brought it here as your last source on the sheet, Nishmas Avram, has a very interesting piece of permission here. I thought this was an eyebrow raiser. In source number 15, he was asked a question about, as you see here, a doctor who works a shift in a Jewish hospital. And the doctor receives a detailed account on his stub at the end of the month stating, this is what you get for this shift, this is what you get for this shift, and so on, including the Shabbos shift, which he adds in parentheses is actually greater than he's getting for the weekday shift. That's a side note. So I would have expected that's a problem. That's no longer havla'ah. It's not absorbed with everything else. Right? Rabbi, and maybe you could justify it under one of the other points. It's a mitzvah, it's a communal need. You could make those arguments, but havla'ah shouldn't work. He says, no. Rabbi Yeshua Neuver told me this is permitted. Number one, because the Mishnah Berurah permits, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, permits a midwife to be paid, and the same is true for all those involved in the patient's needs. Further, it's not called Shabbat payment as it is in Havla'ah, and it is permitted. He mentions Havla'ah. I don't understand why that's Havla'ah. You specifically broke it out and said, this is Tuesday, and this is Wednesday, and this is Shabbos. But that's, he says, that counts as Havla'ah as well. Yes?
Is it possible for the doctor to regard the payment as Havla'ah, but to defer to the hospital to make their own calculation in the way they make their calculation? The time and a half on weekends, not my problem. I consider it to be part of my overall pay for all the shifts that I worked over the course of that week. It doesn't matter to me how to do that.
Maybe. He doesn't break it out to explain. I often write to him by email and ask him questions about things, but usually it's not just for a clarification, or I would ask him. Usually it's like there's a practical question. Maybe I'll save it until there's a practical question and throw that into the email as well. That could be the rational. It's just very. It seems. I would have liked to have for him to have said so.
But in general, would it be permissible to rationalize something on the basis that, okay, I'm looking at this side of the equation, and the other party in the transaction is able to look at it in a completely different way. We end up with the same value on both sides of the equation. How they figure it out does not necessarily impact on how I have to perceive it or be governed by it or the law that may apply to me for being part of this transaction.
Right. It's an interesting idea. I don't know. It's an interesting idea. I hear what you're saying. Part of this is the question of whose prohibition is it in the first place? And that goes back to the comment that Rabbi Waldenberg made before about the perspective of the physician versus the perspective of the patient. Right? According to him, Havla'ah was about the physician's ability to accept the payment. So if so, what you're saying makes sense. The physician says, I'm getting a paycheck for the month. I don't care about what was for which day. So maybe that is indeed a vile argument. I don't know. I hear what you're saying. the last points that I wanted to make with this, and then I'll do a very fast summary, is even if payment is permitted, it may not be discussed on Shabbos. There's a completely separate prohibition against discussing payment for services on Shabbos, and that would apply here. And the last thing is that Tzitz Eliezer points out, you can always give a gift after Shabbos. And always the case where you came to somebody's house and, you know, whatever it was, the child was complaining of a toothache and they took a look at it, or a fever or whatever it was, there's nothing that stops you from giving a gift to them after Shabbos. That's not called Schar Shabbos. That's not called Shabbos payment, and would be fine. So again, just to summarize very briefly, we dealt with the issue of refusing to treat without payment. We gave several different reasons why one would be obligated to treat even without payment, whether it's the Beit Din is going to compel him to work, or it's morally wrong for him to refuse, or you can't just say, well, there are other doctors because you may be uniquely suited for this patient. We talked about the strikes and the actual case that happened in 1983, and there were some rabbis who said flat, you can't do it, and others said you can, as long as you make sure that your patients are going to be taken care of. And we noted that according to the view of Atzei HaLevanon, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Zirilson, that you have to make sure you're not just saving lives, but you have to make sure that people are getting adequate care. That sets the bar much higher. What was the reason for that? People, I was wondering. You cancel elective surgeries, and therefore you didn't have all the downsides that can come with those. Well, yeah, I was wondering if that was flat mortality rate, if that was per procedure, or... Yeah, interesting. Okay. And it's interesting also, because I would have expected higher mortality because the people you take are the ones who are a great need. In other words, the people you're taking are the high risk cases. Yeah. Okay. Go figure. But the issue of work payment for work on Shabbos, everyone seems to agree that it's fine. The only debate is what the rationale is. Is it havla'ah? It's absorbed in with the fact that they make themselves available in general. Is it because they're doing a mitzvah? Is it because there's a danger to the community if you wouldn't pay people to do this? All of these different justifications are brought for this. God willing, our next session is... When? It's not for a while. Do you remember, Jeff? No, it's before June. It's before June, but it's not yet. All right, God willing, if you're on the email list for these sessions, and that's a good time to remind you to please sign in, then you will find out when the next session is. Thank you very much.